This is From On Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Desiree Sheldon was just 2 years old when she was brought to Rutland Regional Medical Center on February 19th with signs of head trauma. The Pulteney toddler was transferred to Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, where she died 2 days later. Doctors who treated Desiree suspected abuse, and an autopsy concluded that her death was caused by blunt force head trauma, and police are calling it a homicide. The child's stepfather, Dennis Doobie, has been charged and has pleaded innocent to second-degree murder. Brent Curtis is a reporter for the Rutland Herald who's been following this situation closely. He joins me now from our studios at PEG TV in Rutland. Brent, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Nina. How are you?
I'm well. So Desiree Sheldon was living with her mother and stepfather when she died. What do police allege happened?
Well, on the afternoon of the 19th, while the mother was away from home, police say that Dennis Doobie was in the house alone with the toddler when she suffered multiple fractures to her skull that eventually led to her death.
And as you said, the mother was away, and while police have charged with the child's stepfather, charged the child's stepfather with her death, Desiree's mother, Sandra Eastman, has also come under fire because there were previous allegations of child abuse made against her. Can you talk about what those charges were?
Yes. On Valentine's Day of 2013, she came to the hospital with her daughter with multiple leg fractures that were over a week old for both of them. She eventually pled guilty to a misdemeanor count of cruelty to a child, but it wasn't for necessarily abusing her child. It was for neglect of care. In other words, she didn't bring her child into the doctor's office in a timely manner.
What happened to Desiree at that point? Did the state step in? Was she taken away from her family for a while?
She was taken away for, 7 months. She was placed into the care of her paternal aunt. And that aunt and other family members actually petitioned the Department for Children and Families to allow Desiree to stay with that family and not return her to her mother. But for reasons that we're all wondering, she was eventually returned to her mother and to her stepfather, who, by the way, was not living with the family at the time of the prior abuse.
And that whole situation has really stirred up a lot of the heated debate in Rutland County about this, the fact that Desiree was returned to her mother's care. You've spoken with family members. What are they telling you about that?
They're angry. They want an explanation. They want to know why their voices weren't heard or weren't considered as part of that process. Now, most of them, you'll probably hear this talking further on in the show, don't have a voice in the legal process, but the aunt who was taking care of Desiree would have had legal standing during that custody matter.
The commissioner of the Department of Children and Families, David Iacovone, has spoken to upset community members in Rutland about this case. What did he say, and how did people respond?
Well, yeah, I mean, he acknowledged their anger. He said that there would be both an internal and an external investigation, both of which are underway at this point. I guess it's fair to say that people were not satisfied with his answers, and there was a lot of emotion, a lot of anger.
And Dennis Doobie has pleaded innocent to second-degree murder. Some family members say Sandra Eastman, the mother, should be held partly responsible, too. Any changes? Do you expect any changes to be brought against her?
I don't. I've actually spoken with investigators. They do not believe that Sandra had anything to do with her daughter's death. They have both phone records and video recordings indicating her whereabouts. And moreover, they truly believe that she did not have anything to do with the death.
All right. Brent Curtis is a reporter for the Rutland Herald. He joined us from our studios at PEG TV in Rutland. Brent, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nana.
As you can imagine, this case has sparked a lot of emotion and many questions over how the state handles allegations of child abuse and whether its current procedures are adequate. Here to talk with us about that is Doug Racine, Secretary of Vermont's Agency of Human Services, which oversees the Department of Children and Families. Secretary Racine, thank you for being on the program today.
You're welcome, Nina.
So first off, how unusual has this case been for the caseworkers who handle child abuse investigations in the state?
First of all, Nina, and as you know, and I think most of your listeners know, I can't comment on any of the specifics of this case because of confidentiality laws. And before I start to answer that, I just want to express our deep sorrow and sadness and the emotion, all the accompanying emotions about this case. This was a two-year-old child who was a victim of a homicide. However, I can say in general, social workers are upset about this. Our folks in the department and in my agency are charged with protection of children and other vulnerable citizens. And when something like this happens, we feel like maybe there's something more. Did we miss something? So we're asking all those sorts of questions of ourselves. We don't. This is very distressing and very disturbing that this has happened. But moving from the emotions, we have to look at everything that happened in this case to see what might have been done differently.
Well, let me ask you some nuts and bolts questions just regarding reporting child abuse in general. Who is able to report child abuse to the state? I realize anybody can, but there are different categories of folks.
There are folks who are mandated if they see any evidence, and I don't have the complete list because I don't do this on a day-to-day basis, but folks like physicians, teachers, childcare providers, folks in the medical profession, others in the medical profession, folks who come into contact with children on a professional level are mandatory reporters if they see any evidence of abuse or neglect of a child, including what the child may say to them talking about what's going on at home.
And do some reports carry more weight than others?
Not really. I mean, if there's a report, there is an initial investigation. We have to look into them. Sometimes we discover pretty quickly that they aren't substantiated. Others take a whole lot more investigation. When there's been obvious abuse and something that's a serious injury, we get the police involved right away. Law enforcement's very much part of those sorts of investigations. Sometimes we see a family where By definitions, legal definitions of abuse or neglect, nothing that serious has happened. But we see a family that, for whatever reasons, may have children who are at risk, and we try to work with that family and try to move into the prevention mode to help that family get through whatever they're going through at that time to make sure that we can do our best to protect the child.
Well, you talked about investigations, and I'd like you to walk us through some of the specifics that are involved, some of the protocols that are involved when you receive a report of potential or possible child abuse. Someone calls and says, I'm concerned about this child. You say you investigate. How does that actually work? Is there a social worker assigned to each case, or is law enforcement brought in right away? Walk us through the process.
Yeah, there's an initial screening, and I will caution that I don't know all the specifics of this because I don't do this on a daily basis. This is within the Family Services Division of the Department for Children and Families. But I do know there are initial screenings that are done. We talk to the folks who are involved. We talk to others who may be involved with the child to see if there's a good reason to look at this to make sure it's not a baseless accusation. But when we still have questions, we have social workers at our 12 district offices around the state who will do a field investigation. They will go and talk with the family. They'll talk with the child. They'll talk with providers. They will look at the basis for the accusation, and if they see something that looks like child is being abused or neglected, we'll take the next steps, often leading to bringing a child into custody.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about how the state investigates allegations of child abuse Secretary of Human Services Doug Racine is my guest. Listeners, you can weigh into this conversation. Maybe you have a question or a comment for my guest. 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call. Again, 1-800-639-2211, or you can send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. So how many child abuse reports does the state get each year?
I would say thousands, without knowing the specific numbers. I do know that approximately 500 children might come into custody in the course of a year, and there might be several hundred other children who we've identified who may be at risk of abuse or neglect, and we will work with those families. So this is, this is a very serious problem in the state of Vermont, and we tend to focus on it only when something really tragic happens, as in this case. There's abuse and neglect of children, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse of children going on a lot more in the state than we would like to admit.
And when abuse is substantiated, who is involved in making the decision to take a child away from its parent and move that child, say, to foster care or to a relative's care?
Well, again, it starts with the investigation, and when a social worker and social worker supervisors feel that the child should come into custody, that process begins. It's a court process, but a guardian is appointed for the child, called a guardian ad litem. An attorney is appointed to represent the child's interests. The parents get attorneys if they wish to have them to represent them and to protect them. The state's attorneys get involved because abuse and neglect are criminal actions. And finally, a judge will make a determination and make the final determination. So there are lots of checks and balances in this system. There are a lot of people who are looking over the shoulders of the social workers and the Department for Children and Families to make sure that we're making the best judgments possible and making the best decisions possible. And then, like I said, ultimately, it's up to a judge to make the final decision after listening to everybody involved, including the Department for Children and Families.
We've got a couple of callers who'd like to weigh in today. Let's go to Huntington and talk to Lindsay. Hi, Lindsay. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thanks for having my question on here.
Sure. Go ahead.
So my name is Lindsay Delorier, and I'm the acting director now of the Vermont Early Childhood Alliance. I'm calling to flag a bill that's in the legislature now, H-73, which would create an office of a child advocate or a child ombudsman in the state, which is to say an independent advocate who could intervene on behalf of a child or a family receiving services from the Agency of Human Services. The Early Childhood Alliance has been supportive of this legislation and has been following the lead advocacy group working on it, Voices for Vermont's Children. But we believe that the recent death of Desiree Sheldon highlights the real immediacy of the need for this office in our state, and we've elevated this to a top priority of our legislative agenda this year. So my question is whether Secretary Racine and the agency in general have familiarity with this proposal, and I'm interested to know whether he perceives the need for the creation of this office in Vermont now, particularly given the recent tragedy.
Thanks for that call, Lindsay. Secretary Racine, what about this H-73 bill?
Lindsay and Nina, I'm not that familiar with H-73 now. I know it's out there. I don't know what the legislature has done with it. I have not been part of the discussions in the agency about this, but I'd certainly be willing to consider that. Obviously, I have to look at all the implications of that. How much is involved? Is there a cost to the state? What legal standing would the office have? And all those sorts of technical questions. But I think it's important that we have lots of different perspectives on the safety of children. But what I just described is a process where there are at least two individuals, a guardian ad litem and an attorney, who are there in this process to represent the interests of the child. They have legal standing. They have standing in front of a court. So, yes, another look would always be helpful. I don't know specifically about this bill and what its standing would be in the process.
Secretary Racine, you talked about the fact that the state gets well over 1,000 reports of child abuse a year. You weren't specific on that number.
I don't know the specific number.
I'm wondering about the caseload of the individual social workers who are involved in investigating each of these claims.
Right now, we have a staff to case ratio of about 1 to 16. 3 years ago, after there were a lot of budget cuts and position cuts as a result of the recession and budget cuts, it was 1 to 20. So since Governor Shumlin has come into office, we have added 27 social workers around the state. That's more than two per office. So we have that ratio of 1 to 16. The goal is 1 to 12. So, you know, do we have enough? We're doing better. Do we have an ideal number? No, we probably don't. And there isn't anybody involved in state child protection work who won't say they need more social workers to do these sorts of investigations. But we're a lot better off today than we were, and a lot of the stresses in that system that were there 3 years ago are not as severe as they were.
You mentioned that the ideal is one caseworker for every 12 cases, and I believe Commissioner Iacovone has said that that's the national best practice ratio.
Yes.
How optimistic are you, or is there a goal that within a certain number of years Vermont will attain that?
You know, we don't have a specific goal, but we have been, we made efforts in the first two budget cycles with the Shumlin administration to add those positions. We've addressed other priorities across the agency and across state government for positions as well. But anybody who follows the legislature knows how difficult it is to add positions. There is a lot of political reluctance to add positions to state government. I will say that when I got the job that I have now as secretary, and Dave Iacovone came in at the same time as commissioner, that was the first area we addressed. We were talking about child safety, and we went to the governor and said, "Governor, we need to add these positions." And Governor Shumlin was willing to go in front of the legislature in his budget through the budget process to say we need these positions, and the legislature approved them. Would I like to see more? Yes, I would.
All right. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about how the state investigates allegations of child abuse. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211 or post your comments on our Facebook page or at vpr.net. Secretary Racine, I'd like to ask you about several investigations that are now underway. Right now, I believe there are four investigations: the criminal investigation involving Desiree's stepfather, Dennis Doobie, then the DCF internal investigation, which I understand is standard, plus an external investigation, which the governor called for, and now a Senate review panel, which is unusual and which we'll talk more about in just a few minutes. Secretary Racine, talk about how the internal DCF investigation and the external investigation will differ. Who's handling each of those, and how will they proceed?
Well, they're different in that one is done by the Department for Children and Families, the senior management, including the deputy commissioner for the Division of Family Services, as well as the commissioner. And I am staying in close contact with the commissioner and his folks as this investigation gets underway. They will review everything that happened, every step in the process. They'll be looking at the policies we have in place. They'll be looking at the statutes that we have in place. And they'll be looking at the process that occurred after the department's initial involvement. And so that's standard. That happens anytime there's a case like this where there's been a DCF involvement. So that process will go along. They will make they'll make their recommendations for any changes that might be needed. And that's when the external review kicks in. That is done by a group called the Vermont Citizens Advisory Board. It's set up by federal law. It's independent of state government. It is what it says. It's a citizens group which advises the Department for Children and Families. So they will do, as they do in all serious cases, they will do a review of the Department for Children and Families investigation, and then they will make their own recommendations. But I will say this one is going to be done in a way that's different from the way others have been done. They have already met. They understand the serious nature of this. It is different from others. They're going to do their normal review, but they may take other steps after they do their initial review. They've added members to this board. There are three members who are state government employees who are being recused from this investigation. So it's completely independent of state government. They've appointed a co-chair to Dr. Joe Hagen, a Burlington pediatrician, is the chair. They've appointed Sally Borden, who is the director of KidSafe Collaborative in Burlington. It's a child protection prevention group. She has experience in social work. They've added a former state's attorney. They've added Chief Michael Sherling of the Burlington Police Department. So there's a law enforcement person. Retired Judge Ben Joseph, there. Senator John Campbell asked to be placed on it, and he has been. They're talking about other legislators. So this is a group that normally meets in these cases, but they've really elevated its status in this one to include a lot of other people. So we have as many perspectives as possible.
Listeners, we're looking at how the state investigates child abuse allegations and what happens within families where abuse has occurred. Coming up, we'll talk with Rutland Senator Peg Flory. Flory and other Rutland lawmakers have asked for a state Senate panel to look into questions that have been raised by Desiree Sheldon's death. We'll get to that and to callers who are waiting to weigh in. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're talking with the head of the agency that oversees child abuse investigations, Secretary of Human Services, Doug Racine. I'd like to bring in another voice to our discussion now, Rutland Senator Peg Flory. She and two colleagues requested that Senate leadership create a special panel to look into the statutes that govern child abuse in the state. Senator Flory, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Nina.
So what kind of reaction has there been to this whole situation in Rutland County?
Oh, obviously people are very concerned, very upset about the whole situation. A lot of questions about it, a lot of anxiousness, a lot of anger.
The state is already, as we talked about, conducting internal and external investigations or planning to take on those investigations. What can a legislative investigation uncover that those processes cannot?
I'm not sure. I think be better able to answer that in a few months. I think the pro tem's reason for agreeing to do this is to cover a variety of things. Our first task, and we'll be having our first meeting this week. The first task is to raise some questions that we want this citizens group to be able to answer for us. It's our plan on working closely with these other groups to see if, in fact, this is an isolated incident, or is it an indicator of some systemic problem in the system that should be fixed legislatively. And I think that's where we come in, is what went wrong in this case that is not isolated to this case, that is in other systems, other cases as well. And is there something that we ought to do legislatively to make it so that we can try to prevent this from happening to anyone else's child?
In other words, making changes to the policy that's already in place.
The policy and the statutes, keeping in mind that some are federal, but differentiating between what is what we have to do under the federal mandates versus what we have flexibility on. And on those issues, is there a way we could do it better that requires statutory changes? That's, I think, our primary goal. And the difficulty is we have to and really want to be very cautious that we are not doing anything that would end up compromising the police investigation and ultimate prosecution of the perpetrators of this incident.
Let me go to the phone lines now and bring some callers into this discussion. Let's go to Barry and talk with Hannah. Hi, Hannah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, if there's an animal that's abused, we remove that animal from its abuser. And if a woman is abused, we encourage that woman to stay away from her abuser and give her a lot of resources to get away from her abuser. But the ultimate goal of DCF is reunification of families. So why are we trying to put the most vulnerable members of our society back with their abusers?
Let me throw that to Secretary Racine, because this is a comment that's come up a lot. I've seen this in a lot of letters to the editor where people are worried that, you know, what is the threshold of returning a child to a home where problems have been documented? Secretary Racine.
It depends upon an evaluation of continuing risk to that child and the severity of the original abuse. We follow the best practices of every state. Every state does this. I wouldn't say the only goal is reunification. I think it's a goal if it can be done. We see cases that are more severe, sometimes cases less severe. But what happens is we look at what's happened in the family and the cause for that abuse or the cause for that neglect, and to see if the family is willing to work through that. There are times where there have been mental health issues. There have been stresses in the family. There may be substance abuse issues. And if the family has addressed those in a successful way, then there would be a time where the child might go back part-time, might go back full-time, where the family is monitored. And then if the judgment is that the child will be safe in that family, then the goal is reunification. But I also want to say that anytime that happens, the same process occurs that occurred in bringing a child into custody in the first place. The child has the guardian ad litem. The child has an attorney. The family has attorneys. The state's attorney has been involved in that decision, and ultimately it's up to the judge to make that call. Last year, 40% of children under six who came into our custody went back to their parents. In 60% of the cases, they stayed in the custody of the state.
Senator Flohr, you said that you want the legislative panel to look at whether the criteria for reuniting children with their parents are set appropriately. What are your concerns there?
There have been concerns voiced to most of us. How do you define abuse? Why isn't a parent using heroin in front of their child automatically abuse, defined as abuse? What are the criteria for abuse currently? What's the training for investigators? Is using DCF as investigating the most financially responsible and the most prudent way to do it? Or should we use our trained police force to investigate it? Some of those issues. And the secretary was absolutely correct. It isn't simply DCF. It is DCF and all of the ancillary entities that deal with this. It affects our schools. The schools are dealing with it. And because everything that happens in these child abuse cases is confidential, it makes it incredibly difficult for everyone to work as a team to try to best protect these children.
And Senator Flory, you've talked about that whole confidentiality issue is part of the reason why there may be some mistrust for the Department of Children and Families. Do you think that your panel, the legislative panel, might be able to look into that? Is that a concern of yours?
Oh, I'm sure that's one of the areas we will be looking into. I mean, I do family law, and things come up in divorce court that, you know, you really don't want the world to know, yet it's on public record in court. But yet the same things, when it involves DCF, are done in chambers, are done under the seal of confidentiality that the world doesn't know about. And any time you don't know how something works, the public mistrusts it.
Sure. Well, Senator Flory, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Nina.
That's Rutland County Senator Peg Flory. And I'd like to give Secretary Doug Racine one last question. Senator Flory mentioned that she wants to better understand the mistrust that seems to be percolating around the Department of Children and Families. A lot of what you do is not made public because of privacy issues. As head of the agency, what sorts of things can be done to improve how people feel about the organization and the level of trust they can place in it?
Well, the first thing is when something happens like this case, having that external review. It is independent. There are people who are going to look at this case and make recommendations, and their report and their recommendations will be public in the end, to the extent that is possible. But I think we need to talk more about what's going on in our state and the level of abuse and neglect of our children. It's a serious problem. It continues to be serious. Numbers of reports are going up every year. Child sexual abuse is unfortunately happening much too often. And we need to talk about what we do. We are aggressive. Some people think we're too aggressive in bringing children into custody. We are more likely to bring children into custody in this state than most other states out there, because we're trying to err, if we're going to err at all, on the side of the safety of the children. So I think just talking about it more will probably help people understand what it is we're trying to do.
And we'll have to make that the final word. Doug Racine has the Vermont Agency of Human Services. Secretary Racine, thank you for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Listeners, we know this subject has been a difficult one, so we're going to take a short break. But when we come back, I invite you to join me in our performance studio, where we'll lighten the mood with some amazing live music from the Beerworth Sisters. And you can't help but tap your toes when they start singing I Promise. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. Well, I'm now standing in the VPR Performance Studio, where I'm joined by Julia Beerworth and Anna Pepin. Together, they are the Beerworth Sisters, a two-piece band from the Burlington area, and we're so excited to have them live on Vermont Edition. Julia and Anna, thanks for coming in and playing for us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're very excited. Thank you.
So why don't you start us off with one of your songs? How about Simple Things?
Great. not enough. Now I know it's the simple things that matter most, or so I've been told, and now I know. I miss your smile and the charm you show.
Is Simple Things by the Beerworth Sisters, the title track from their first CD. Julia Beerworth and Anna Beerworth Pepin are accompanied by Tim Swanson on violin, and everybody in the studio is just smiling. That was beautiful. Your style has been described as, I saw it written, spare and elegant, unassuming with a touch of whimsy, harmony-laden, acoustic Americana. What's it like when you hear how other people describe your music? And how do you both describe your music? Julia.
Well, it's a compliment to hear those things said about our music. It's certainly really fun to go out and play with Anna and Tim Swanson. And it's almost like magical when we're playing together. So when other people like it, it really means a lot to us. So it's really wonderful to hear those things. Thank you.
And Anna, you're both Beerworths, but not really sisters, kind of sort of sisters. So Anna, maybe you can explain the connection.
Yeah, it's a little confusing. She's actually my sister-in-law. So she married my oldest brother, Andrew. And then I actually just got married 2 years ago. So I'm a Pepin now, but we're Beerworths at heart still.
Yes, we are.
And I want you to talk a little bit about how, you know, it's one thing if you started playing at family gatherings, just brought out your ukulele, which I see you're playing, and or your guitars and just started jamming. But how and when did that transfer over to, hey, let's make a real band and start performing around the area?
Well, we don't play too often. We are very busy, so we're both teachers and have children, so it's really hard to get out and play. And we did start playing in family living rooms and just with each other, which was really fun. But again, we don't, you know, it's really hard to time manage everything. And so we like to get out once or twice a month. And when we do, it's really fun. But it's, you know, we have a lot of different things going on, as everybody does in their lives. And so balancing those things and still making it happen is fun.
Well, let's give listeners another song. What would you like to play for us next?
We're going to play Summer of 24.
All right.
In the fateful summer of 24, two men made a push for the peak of evermore, but they ran out of time, of strength, and of air. In the fateful summer of 24, one man named Irvin had a camera in his pocket, the other never know if they reached the top to see it all before their epic and their fatal fall. In the fateful summer of 24, two men made a push for the peak of evermore. For the peak of
and you're listening to the Beerworth Sisters, who just performed Summer of 24. And I think we have time. I'd really like to get one more song in. What's the third song that you both are going to play for us today, or all three of you, actually?
It's called Little Tune.
Let's hear it.
Great.
Beerworth and Anna Beerworth Pepin are the Beerworth Sisters. They were accompanied today by Tim Swanson on violin. Huge, huge thank you for coming in and playing live for us. It was beautiful.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here, and there's great people working here, so thank you very much for having us.
And listeners, we'll have information on the Beerworth Sisters if you want to learn more about them on our website, vpr.net. And that is our program today. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Devin Karambalis. Mary Williams directed our show today. Chris Albertine and John Billingsley engineered our live music performance with the Beerworth Sisters. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Nina Kank. Thanks so much for listening.